Today I talk with poet Maya Salome about her poetry collection, How to Bake an Algorithm in the Microwave, which won the prestigious Atul Adnan Poetry Prize in 2022. The judges remarked, quote, Maya Salome's poetry stood out for its inventiveness in cracking the code of life between system and culture. The turns and swerves the poems make are astonishing. The expectations they upend are remarkable. As a testament to the aesthetic boundaries and intellectual revolt, poets of Arab heritage are pushing, breaking, and reinventing. End quote. We talk about what led Maya to both technology and poetry, language and storytelling, and the challenges and joys of representing life in the diaspora. In a time of war and genocide, Salome's poetry shows how patterns of life and reproduction and desire persist. In her readings and discussions of three poems, we find a new lexicon and a new grammar for today's life. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. Thank you again for being on the show. It's so wonderful to have you on. I was struck by the title of your collection and, of course, this prestigious prize that it won. I watched one of your YouTube interviews when you were asked about how you got an interest in technology, and you gave a really interesting response about surveillance. Could you talk a little bit about this?
So I'm Arab American. I grew up in San Diego, which is home to a very significant Navy base. And I was born the year before 9/11. And I think growing up, I feel that I carried this feeling of being watched, whether it was warranted or not, the verdict remains. I know that we grew up hearing clicks on our home phone when we called back home to Syria and Lebanon. I know that my mother was oftentimes pulled over in those years for not very good reasons. And growing up as an Arab person in America in that time, and increasingly in this time now, I would argue actually that the last 3 years are even worse in terms of Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism than they were in the years post 9/11, especially now, because our technological advancements have created the ability for the government to invade our privacy in new and completely unimagined and unprecedented ways. And then I went to Stanford. And Stanford is the house of Silicon Valley and the hub of technological innovation, so to speak. And my best friend was a computer science major. And a lot of the people that I interacted with were computer science majors. I was a psych. And then I took the most easy CS class you could take at Stanford. It was like CS 106 was like 101, and then there was 105. I took 105. So technically, I still don't really understand much of the way computers work. But I was lucky enough to learn about the language and structure of computing. And it made me curious as I was surrounded by dialogues, not only about the surveillance of Arab and Muslim communities, but also about technology, innovation, and progress, what those conversations meant for an Arab person in an increasingly stalker and surveillance state. I think all of those things and experiences coalesced into my curiosity and mild obsession with the language of computers and the desire to surveil the computer back or to get into the innards of technological devices, which I think we often see as impersonal.
I never knew the etymology of the word algorithm. Could you share that with us? It's a fascinating story.
I have the book in front of me here because I remember that this was something I actually came across after the book was pretty much mostly done.
I thought it might have been at the beginning, but no, this is interesting.
And I was like, how perfect. So algorithm derives from the Latin noun algorithmus, which is a mangled transliteration of the Arabic name al-Khwarizmi, who is a mathematician who introduced algebra to Europe. So I love etymology. I was a huge like spelling bee etymology nerd in middle school and continue to be one. But I just thought how fitting that there is an Arabic root for the word algorithm.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So now we know about technology, Stanford, algorithm, language. So let's make the move from that into poetry. How did you get into poetry?
I was very lucky. My father was a poet, and he always encouraged my curiosity about poetry and writing. And I was lucky that he gave me The Prophet. And so that was like probably one of the first poetry books I ever read. And when I finished that, I was like, this is amazing. I need more. And so like me at 11 or 12 years old, just like Arab poets, Arabic and poetry. Because the canon that we were mildly exposed to in public school English class was maybe some Shakespeare, etc.
Yeah.
And those things never lit my fire or made me curious, but Khalil Gibran's work and words were so evocative. I still remember he had some line about your children are arrows and you pair them and then you release them. And so much of his work was so spiritual and philosophical. And it also, I think, helped set up a framework for the type of poet that I wanted to be. And I knew immediately, like, I developed a hunger and an obsession. And I always use the word obsession because my friend told me, I'm like a very neurotic reviser. And she said, you have an obsession that is only born of real love. And it's true. Poetry is like one of the great loves of my life. And I think it's probably the longest relationship I'll ever have. Yeah. I read a lot of poetry. Also, I wrote like these short stories, even as like pretty young, like first, second grade. And the stories kept getting shorter and shorter. My family used to go to Damascus and Syria and Lebanon every summer for 3 months until 2011 when the civil war broke out in Syria. And then in 2015, we made our first return after that gap. And my father and I went to Lebanon for 2 weeks. And being back in one of my two homelands as like a more fully formed person and not like a young child, I was like, wow, this is the first time I've been in an Arabic speaking Arab place as a teenager. And it's the first time I feel that I belong. To the extent that was true or not, I'm obviously irrevocably American. I speak broken Arabic. I don't think I could ever live in Lebanon or Syria. And I think that's another really important position that I try to center in my work. Like, without romanticizing the homeland, without not acknowledging the own privileges of my blue passport. But for what it was worth, at 15 years old, it was a life-changing trip. And I wrote my first official poem on the plane back to San Diego from that trip. And I feel that was like a formative kind of moment for me in knowing that I had a feeling that I had a story to tell and wanting to put it to paper in the form of poetry.
It's so interesting the way you describe your poetry, because one word that leaps to mind when I think about your poetry, it's very hybrid, right? It's poetry, but it's also graphic. It's also storytelling. And I was thinking your collection wins this amazing literary prize, Eta Anan. And she's just, to me, is the epitome, this kind of mosaic of words that don't stick simply to poetry, although they do in an amazingly powerful way. And it was also interesting to me that one of the judges is Fadi Judah, who's an old friend, and he has that collection called Textu, which came out a few years ago. So I'm thinking about how the three of you, at least, are combining these different forms in a really interesting way. So could you tell me a little bit about your influences? Because you have Eta Anan, Fadi, you mentioned Vanessa Villarreal, Fanny Choi, Amy Winehouse. So how do these people all come into your life and into your work?
I love that you brought up Eta Anan. She is like my North Star. She is probably like the most influential writer I've ever read. I've read much of her books now. The one that was the most influential in developing this book, at that point in 2020, I had read two of her books, maybe three. I had read Sim Marie Rose, which was like a short novella about the Lebanese Civil War, specifically the position of a female school teacher in navigating those sectarian and religious conflicts. It's a gorgeous piece. I had also read The Arab Apocalypse, which is such like an innovative and remains a very innovative work. And her use of symbology of like breathlessness and caesuras, those I think very clearly show their influences in this book. And I think I mentioned this in the notes to the book, but beyond like Eta Anan's spirit, her work, her tone, her formal and textual innovations, the two books and pieces that really helped inform this book were Vanessa Villarreal's Beast Meridian, which is a gorgeous book, and I recommend to everyone. It's formally innovative. Again, I was a psych major, and she cites to like psychological acculturation literature and like what a creative way to bring the academic canon into the more visceral reality of subjecthood. I think in the next book I'm working on also investigates a little bit of like psychological research and literature. And this, it's something I touch on this book, but I've always had an interest in like defacing the canon or science or traditional Western knowledge and the way it's presented. And I think Vanessa's book does such a great job of incorporating footnotes and like placing anecdotal storytelling at the same level of value or authority as official scholarship. And she also touches on this sense of like monstrous and visceral and lush girlhood, which I think is also like a really central tenet of my own writing is girlhood and lately womanhood. I noticed that the word girl recurs in the microwave books so often. And now I just turned 25. I'm like, I guess I'm not a girl anymore. I'm a woman.
But you're in law school too.
I think I'm kind of an adult at this point. But yeah, Vanessa's book was so important to How to Make an Algorithm in the Microwave. And then the second book that was super huge was Franny Choi's Soft Science. That in that book, she talks also a lot about the construction of science and technology. And specifically, she investigates the figure of the cyborg, specifically like a gendered raced cyborg through the lens of her own Asian diasporic experience. And obviously, beyond it being gorgeously written, it also provided a really useful framework for me as I was thinking about the intersections of race, gender, and technology. Yeah, I'm just like obsessed with those books. And then like more generally, Atala Adnan, Nizar Abani, a really huge like Syrian and romantic poet, the work of June Jordan. There's a poem after June Jordan.
Yeah, I love that one,
Yeah, I feel so very lucky to be part of such a long lineage of female feminist decolonial writers and also to learn so much from Khaled Matawa. His translation work is so important. And so many of the Arab poets that I've read, I wouldn't have been able to access if they were completely in Arabic. He does these wonderful translations of Maram al-Masri, Adonis, Nizar Abani. And when I find bilingual editions, it's nice because my Arabic is like slightly good enough that I can like read the Arabic version and be like, okay, I don't know what that word means. What does it mean in English? But the work of translators is so important. Mm. And it has allowed me to access much more poets than I could have without them.
Yeah. So what about Amy Winehouse?
Amy Winehouse. There was a summer in my freshman year of college, I randomly got a scholarship to go to the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing. And this was like my first ever writer's residency. I was very excited. I'd never been to Martha's Vineyard. And so I went and I've always listened to Amy Winehouse, but I affiliate like that summer specifically, like August in 2019, there was something about the heat in Massachusetts. I now remember that week over there as like a fever dream. They had set me up in this like cottage with no Wi-Fi. It was so hot. So all I could remember was I had my Amy Winehouse playlist downloaded and I just listened to it over and I was obsessively working on some of the poems in the book. And now like looking back on it, I'm like, I was in a fever dream trance and just only seeing Amy Winehouse for a week. But I think there's also something about her figure. And again, this is something I struggle with as a writer. And even now in the new book, as we think about historical female figures, especially celebrities like Amy Winehouse, who was taken advantage of by many people in her life, how do you write about someone that you don't know without turning them into a symbol or into a one-dimensional type of tool in your own work? And I think what drew me to her was her vulnerability. Obviously, she has this gorgeous voice. And also, there was something so vulnerable and intimate about the songs she sang. As a survivor myself, I felt that we had things in common. Who knows if we did, but I felt that way. And there's a video, I think one of her last performance videos, and she's like trying to get through the song. And you can tell that she is either inebriated or like just not well. And watching things like that makes me think about the ways that women have been taken advantage of and used for their voice and for their cultural production.
Yeah,
I still don't know if I have a right answer, if I did her justice in the way that I wrote about her or towards her, but I felt somehow that we had things in common, that she had given me something through her art. And so I hope maybe that I gave her something through mine.
Oh, no, it really comes across. And I think in certain of your poems, you do compare her to female singers in Arabic, which I thought was really interesting and resonant.
The elegiac mode that she enters is very reminiscent for me of like the Feroz and Umm Kulthum songs that I grew up around.
No, it really comes across well. It's both very concrete, but also very atmospheric. And I understand how it could occupy all those different roles in one's life. You said that the first poem was influenced by Choi's glossary of terms, and your poem is entitled cast.html. But In Choi's glossary of terms, she sets it up like a table and used the table form in different ones of your poems, but you chose not to do that for your first poem. It reads more like the beginning of a play, the dramatis personae, and so many of the recurring figures that I see are mother slash daughter, but then apartment, building, blood, nature. How did you assemble this cast of characters that saturate and punctuate, maybe is a better word, at different moments, uneven intervals, but very coherently in some ways, the entire collection?
I love that question. In terms of the formatting, I think all of us have like moves that we do as writers. And one of my favorite moves is like putting things in boxes. So I was like, I'm going to subvert that pattern and not put the thing in a box just because it feels good or cool to me for no reason.
Mm.
And then I also wanted it to show up like the introduction to a play. I had read one or two plays, and I think there's something very interesting about the way that screenwriters format their work. And so I was like, let me try something different. And then when I came up with the idea of a framing poem, I think the title sets up obviously like a focus on technology. And I wanted that. But I also wanted there to feel like the reader was entering the book with a sense of not only the technologies, but the people and places that I felt had informed the poetry. And so I also took this as an opportunity to try to poetically bring in some of these computer words that I knew were going to recur a lot. So like loop, Boolean, and recursion were big ones for me. And
yeah.
I was aware that like people probably haven't heard these words very often before, most people. And so I figured it would be interesting at least to bring them up, even if I wasn't really explicitly or excessively defining them, at the very least to bring them up as a word of note so that people, if they felt like looking things up. I don't know if people have different feelings about how much do you explain, whether that's if you're writing a word in Arabic, do you put the translation or if you're using a new word? I tend to err on the side of I don't feel like translating myself. And
yeah.
If somebody wants to look something up, they can. I write primarily for Arab American women. And so I know that those people will likely understand what I'm saying without having to look it up. And folks who are visiting my work who are not of that background, wonderful. You can probably appreciate it without having to look it up. But if you want to look it up, it's a piece of work and curiosity and research that you get to participate in as being like a participant and reader of my work. And so the tangent being that I wanted to put all these characters together. I wanted Amy and the Virgin Mary and Phaedrus to be together, at least in one piece, so that the braiding of them across the book felt at least not as jarring as I worried it might be.
I love the fact that you have both animate and inanimate characters, right? And the recurring figure for me is the apartment building. So what's going on with that?
I grew up in a two-bedroom apartment for most of my life until I was like 14. And again, I think this is a struggle between how do I talk about places like Damascus or Aleppo or Beirut when those are places that I don't live and that I didn't grow up in, that very small snatches of my life in. Okay, so I have an idea of them. I have my own romanticized conception of them. They exist as places which are much more complex than I could ever understand as an American. And so what can I offer as something that is more true to my life than my own experience? What I do know is the apartment I grew up on Baltimore Drive. What I do know is the 405. And what I do know is the bonds on Medford Street. And so I was trying to bring in both. And again, I think that diasporic poets, we have our own relationship to the homeland and to distance. And I think we get to write about those things. And I think it's important that we be careful about that. And I also think that we should write about the things that we know and our experiences here in America, which is also our new country for all intents and purposes, as difficult as that might be. And so I was trying to be as honest as I could about all the cities that I felt a connection to. Obviously, San Diego is the one that I lived in and that I knew the best. And so I figured that by offering more than just the name of the city, and in fact, apartment blocks and freeways and intersections, that I could offer more texture and honesty about the experiences that I was talking.
That's a great answer, because they become connectors between these spaces in a really interesting way. And then you often add in like a color or a fruit or something like that could easily coexist in both those places. So you're making these connections, which I love. You mentioned certain words that show up in programming, and the one that caught me was recursion. And I realized as we were talking half a second ago that all these words came from another usage, right? Tech glommed onto them. And with our great mystification by technology these days. We think that's the origin story, but actually, no, they got them from someplace else. And what I think also characterizes a lot of what you do in this book is that you break down the barriers between the two. Language serves as a very interesting kind of almost point of transcendence that gets us past tech and back to what language does with or without technology. And one of the figures that kept on coming back is the recursion thing. Tell me how that works in programming and then how you used it as a poetic figure.
I had learned it in my little baby class. I forget now what it actually means.
Well, I wrote it down someplace. In my notes, I have, in computer science, recursion is a method of solving a computational problem where the solution depends on solutions to smaller instances of the same problem. Recursion solves such recursive problems by using functions that call themselves from being within their own code. The approach can be applied to many types of problems, and recursion is one of the central ideas of computer science. So I just, total parentheses, I didn't even know whether I was going to mention this before, but I may as well, since we're being personal here. Way back when I was a beginning graduate student at Berkeley, so this is 100 million years ago, I got a job working in a bank that basically they rented out their big mainframe computers. We're talking about IBM 360 OS, these mega machines that you, the operations now you could do on your iPhone very easily, probably better. But back then, I worked my way through graduate school working two 12-hour shifts on the weekend, which is perfect because then I had the whole week free as long as I caught up on my sleep. And this was a job, I don't even know if it exists anymore, it's called a computer operator. And we were taking data on almost like ticker tape, but magnetic tape. You would phone up a hospital and they would put their data on a spool of magnetic tape and you would take it in. And at one point they said, David, you come this far, would you like to be a computer programmer? And I thought, sounds like too much work. So that was the breakaway point. And I could have been wealthy. And you can imagine all these fantasies that would never come true. So tell me about how recursion works in your poetry.
And thank you for sharing that. I'm fascinated with the way that computers work, even half a generation or a generation ago, because like you said, it would take, again, the scale of technological innovation is very hard for like people my age or younger to understand, but it is, and I'm afraid to imagine, and AI is a whole different conversation, but I'm afraid to imagine what things will look like in 10 years. Like it, yeah, things are moving so exponentially fast.
Just coincidentally, yesterday I interviewed Karen Howe. Do you know her book, Empire of AI? It's a great book. It points out how much human-dependent AI is, actually. And she calls it empire because she says data is the new colonialism. So that's a plug for her. And since you mentioned AI, I thought I'd mention that to you.
Mark Cuban also said, data is the new oil, the new gold.
And it's Yeah.
We are so unimaginably cooked. I thank you for recommending that book. I look forward to reading it. And to your question about recursion, even when I hear the word now, having forgotten mostly what it meant, it evokes this, right? The recursion. And again, I think it goes back to like obsession or like the iterative research process, the obsessive research process. And so where in recursion, it's an operation is repeated over and over with a smaller and smaller data set until you get the right or real answer. I think, and I also do work in the book to make analogies or comparisons between technological processes and like spiritual ritual. Because a lot of prayer is repetition. And so recursion felt special to me, or was a kind of delicious repeated word to me, because I felt it had some texture of prayer, repetition, and obsession. Wow. And it was similar for loop as well. Recursion, loop. And I'm using my hands because I use words as like very tangible texture. Ideas in my head. So I love those words. I think they're very textured.
No, I really want to say that what I found so powerful about your poetry is it captures so well both, this is something we've just been talking about, captures so well both the disorientation of language, the language of technology that has penetrated our lives and our perceptions of ourselves and the world, our cyborg status, as you mentioned before, but also this in a time of war and genocide when borders are shattered, patterns of life and reproduction and desire persist and yet are embattled. You've given us a new lexicon, a new grammar, which I think is vivid in our lives. You put things together in a way that makes sense in a kind of fantastic way, even for somebody who's of a different gender, a different place and all this, but it's much beyond you in some ways, which is what great poets do. Emanates, but then it extends. And this would be the point in which I would love to ask you to read any of the poems that you would like to share with us, because I always love to have poets voice their work.
I totally agree. And thank you for saying all of that. I feel that you touched on a lot of the things that you write things and hope that that people like them and that they impact them or that they mean something to them. And I think writing is often, at least the process of writing things, is usually pretty lonely. Mm. You're like hunched over your Google Doc and you're by yourself at night. And so
you write on a Google Doc?
Yes.
I thought it would be like a fountain pen on a piece of papyrus.
My thing is, I'm a big forgetter. And because of how busy my school schedule is, usually I'm writing in stolen time in chunks. And so I text my like lines or stanzas. And then I like copy and paste them into this like long running Frankenstein Google Doc. Sit down later and I'm like, what the fuck was I trying to say? And I put things together later.
I would never have guessed that. It seems so organic and of a piece, but thank you for sharing.
Of course. But yeah, thank you. And I know, did you say that you were hoping to hear one or two specific poems? I have poems that I'm happy to read.
It's totally your I have one choice that I want us to end with. Okay. But let's go with yours first.
Okay, so this is Bronchitis is a Beautiful Name for a Girl. California is kindling again. It's been 6 brush fires and a nobody's daughter postulating venials on the hood of a Buick. My brother tugs his sleeves and his lungs stream. We scratch the secondhand Commodore's album and he smiles mundane and lovely at the grocery list. Nail polish, carabiner, Advil fruit. I'm calling because the city is filled with pollutants. Because the duplex with the red roof is falling apart. We argue like tonsils swollen and stubborn. We watch the In-N-Out cashier wash his gloves off in the sink and my shirt makes me look fertile. We laugh about used biology books, the Disney movie about the dragon boy. We make the sky blue. We split the scrambled loons in our stomach. I have an aching letter in my mouth the insurance won't cover, but I'm really afflicted with wanting. The smell of pavement after rain. I'm calling because I have no aunts in this country to call for condoms or advice, but I walk around with pros jammed between my legs. I've never loved the same mistake twice. My brother dances and the song roams through until it finds mine. In a dream, the algorithm broke the windows of it's Massachusetts. I'm a magnesium deficient miracle who only shaves on Thursdays. He's got new Skechers. We make calligraphy with our shoes walking back from school. The rash of coffee shops in El Cajon, the dilapidated bumps on Medford Street. Falling because California is kindling again. And he refuses medicine like I used to. I'm calling because we found the generic for Sudafed and it tasted green. I still bow my head in churches. My survival instinct is too strong.
Wow. That's such a beautiful illustration of what we were talking about previously about this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think I was at the Tin House Writers Workshop this summer, and I noticed that the writers with the strongest regional identities are usually from California and Texas. We have a very strong regional identity. And yeah, I think like a sense of place is very important to know.
How did you bring your brother in? He wasn't one of the cast members that I saw initially. So how did he come into this space?
Yeah. This one came from, I was thinking about this state that I love so much. Oftentimes, I feel that California is my real country more than America is. I'll say I'm a California nationalist. I love this state. I think I will live and remain in this state. And as I was thinking about this state that I love so much and I feel so attached to, and the fact that it is constantly on fire, I think not only is California always burning, but San Diego and much of Southern California is constantly gentrifying and changing. And the neighborhood that I grew up in, La Mesa, is actually now much more expensive and gentrified, like much of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so the coffee shops in El Cajon, the bonds that me and my brother used to walk to, doesn't exist anymore.
Wow.
The neighborhood I grew up in doesn't really exist anymore the way that it did. And so I think I was just thinking about so much of my experience of that neighborhood was me and my little brother walking.
Yeah.
He still is my little bestie. And yeah, I think I was trying to capture that feeling, the nostalgia of an afternoon in the summertime with your little brother.
Yeah. So this is one Californian to another, because, of course, I'm 100 years before, but I grew up in the East Bay. And I feel exactly the way that you do about California being such a special place. But when my family first moved there, which is, again, eons ago, we were the only non-white family. No Hispanics, even. It was such a, it was basically apple orchards and pastures. It was beautiful, but very much set back. It was the first town that you hit on, if you left Berkeley and you went on Highway 24, went through the tunnel, get there. And this is before the BART was built. And I remember taking a Greyhound bus into San Francisco if I wanted to listen to a rock concert. So it was exactly what you were talking about. Now it's like this super affluent, very mixed, which is good, but super affluent. And in an eerie way, it's retained a lot of its sort of pristine beauty, but in a very glossy way, if that makes sense. It's, you don't see the raw nature, you just all laminated almost. Yeah, that's beautiful. And even though we make all of these distinctions, as you well know, being a Southern Californian between the North and the South, I still think the state itself has a kind of larger identity. Yeah.
From the limited time I spent in the Bay, in Palo Alto, which I would say is probably the most boring place in the Bay. But like, I had friends that I made who are from San Jose and the East Bay. And yeah, just hearing about the experience, like the way gentrification has immolated so much of the East and South Bay is really sad. And the way it's displaced primarily communities of color from those places,
yeah,
like, is a very Californian story, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you have another poem that you wanted to share with us?
Yeah, let's see. This is my reading copy, so you'll see all my post-its.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, okay. June Jordan says, maybe I need a woman, maybe I need a man.
Yeah.
Page 69. I stick a croissant in the oven, smear it obnoxious with syrup, leftover craft on the counter and the sheets are foam. I dream of a man in a dark theater endearing my neck, a room with slack paneled walls and the movie playing with sunset. I worry about posting something sweet and frivolous on Instagram because what about materialist dialectalism? I watch theory get made on the television. First girl I notice in homeroom is sticky with lamplight, synonymous with religion, I annotate in my notebook. Anyways, Mary laughed at my gait, or swatched my waist, or the way I watched her walk. Monday. I'm a monsoon, an occasion. Bin. Wall in piles around the bed. Monday. 7 p.m. EST, New England, 94309. I fold the prayer between my legs. I rename it September so the animals behind the camera don't see. It's reported somewhere that I have a pallid allegiance to Dreher's slow-churned rocky road with the whole marshmallows and not the running tracks they paved the other ice cream with. I change my hair in San Francisco, where technocrats speculate against the starving of others. It's marked somewhere I have a mistrust of predictive text. Alternate query. This city is full of my blood. I go outside, rip the grass, stand up with my palms full of soil and rosary, bruised rosary, blooming rosary. Maybe I just need to smoke more and stretch and eat frivolous things in any way I'm working on.
Wow. Tell us about June Jordan, because it was when I turned the page and I saw that, it's just, wow, of course. Yeah.
I adore June Jordan. The last line from the poem is also from this poem that maybe I need a woman, maybe I need a man line is lifted from. And I think her work, it was so daring politically and intellectually for her time. And actually, I recently read a really interesting series of letters between her and Audre Lorde in the LA Review of Books. And it was about, they were arguing about Zionism and about the issue.
Yep. Yep.
And June Jordan is also the one, I believe, who wrote the poem that includes the line, I told you I loved you, I wanted genocide to stop.
Yeah.
And so, I think she has been such a beautiful political and intellectual North Star for me. As my work evolves politically, this book is, I think, less, there's a mention of Israel in this book, but it is less explicitly political
yeah.
than the next book I'm working on. And I think as my own politics change and develop, and as I move further to, I suppose, further to the left, but really, I think the last 3 years of watching, again, constant Arab death on my screen has changed me irrevocably, emotionally, politically, intellectually. And I think that her work remains like a deep source of inspiration and challenges me as I try to grow and think about what is the purpose of American poetry and what is the purpose of writing a poem as an American living in an imperial core, which is murdering Arab people and other people across the world. And so I think, yeah, I love her work. She remains an inspiration to me and to this next book I'm working on. And I also love the way that she finds time for the tender and the quotidian in moments of global disaster. Because even in moments of global disaster, all we have as individual writers is our mundane and our tender and our survival and resistance. And so the way that she finds moments both of ordinary and everyday joy and also of larger intellectual thinking and disclaiming and disownership of our role, again, as American writers in the world, I think is something I'm still thinking about.
The poem I would love to have you read, and you actually feature, I think it's the last poem in the book, because I always like to end the podcast on some note of hope. And maybe you thought so too. Most things are disastrous. It was just a mind-blowingly beautiful poem, and I was so grateful to you for giving it to us. So if you wouldn't mind reading it, I would love to have the audience hear it.
I would love that. I love this piece. And yeah, I think so most things are disasters. But like what, again, as Americans, we have to move beyond anger and despair. And we have to move towards hope and utility. But yeah, thank you for saying that. Most things are disasters. But today, your hair was soft. There was an orange candle on in the shower. The sun was kind, but the wind was impatient. You remembered to wear a jacket, the black denim on it, kissed the cream lining. Your best friend wore it as she went out to get you dinner. And the noodles were perfect, greasy, not too much carrot, grated in your scalp, grated in. Your scalp in bed reeked of coconut. Your nose was pink. Your sister put on eyeliner like the Caspian, drunk against her corneas. You heard a mother apologize to her daughter over the phone after something unforgivable. You heard the 20-something angel say, "I'm proud of you." Part of the reading this week was canceled because the prof with the inherited PhD didn't understand how PDFs work. Pirated Spider-Verse off the site, killing your laptop. Quality was 4 pixels. You remembered to floss. You ignored a mean thought, defamed a boy who deserved it, refrained from telling someone a secret they didn't, imagined a house with a dining table, a brown sofa. Today, you found a picture in your camera roll from when you were young. With the gangly neck, knew you were beautiful before all the blessings, the haircut, and there's still some of that stir fry in the fridge with the malfunctioning lungs and...
Wow. Thank you so much. That's such a beautiful poem, and I go to it whenever I feel the weight of the disasters all around us, but you make us sense life in so many important ways. And remember, you're due back because you mentioned the second book you're working on, which is informed by your actual major, psychology. So that's a ton of stuff to talk about there. But thank you so much for spending time with us and for sharing so much for this beautiful book. It really is mind-blowingly beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure being here and to get to geek out over poetry with you, which is one of my favorite things ever.
Wonderful. Have a good day. Enjoy the rest of your day and let's be in touch.
Yes, I will email you with my bio and my photo, and I look forward to talking with you again very soon. And
Great.
Thank you again. This made my day. Yeah.
Mine too. Take care. Bye-bye.